Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. It's Monday.
It is Monday, which means Anthony's in the house. Mm-hmm. And before we introduce you to some of the folks who were at the U.S. Social Forum that we reported live from last week, I want to take you to an interview I had with Naomi Klein, who is one of our leading thinkers and reporters and journalists and activists, who wrote the book The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She lives in Toronto, which is where the G20 summit was taking place. And she had a really interesting piece in the Globe and Mail, which is Toronto's leading paper, an analysis of what went on at that G20 summit that could affect all of our lives, actually. And it really is an international summit that could affect what happens to our pocketbooks and our societies. So I had a conversation with her earlier today to hear what her analysis was. We share it with you now, then we'll be back for our live show. Naomi Klein, welcome. Good to have you back here on the show with us.
Good to be with you.
You wrote a very interesting piece in the Globe and Mail today, your hometown paper in Toronto, in the wake of the G20 meeting and the G20 demonstrations. Before you launch into that, you took part in the demonstrations as well, didn't you?
I spoke at a big event on Friday night and went to a rally in support of Indigenous rights in Canada. I've been writing about it and participating and wearing, I guess, being an activist journalist. As I say.
not a bad way to live. Let me launch into this. I want to come back to this issue of Indigenous rights and these demonstrations because I think that there's a key link here to a lot that we're missing often in the press. But I'm very curious about this analysis you had of the G20 summit. And what it really meant. I mean, I think that many people who read the paper were shocked when they saw what came out of this G20 summit.
Yeah. I mean, the way I see it is the leaders of the most powerful countries in the world just decided to stick the bill for a financial crisis created by the wealthiest tier of society, to stick that bill with the most vulnerable people in society, the people who had nothing to do with creating the crisis. Because what was decided in Toronto at the G20 summit was for governments to cut their deficits in half by 2013, which is a deep, draconian cut for a lot of countries. I mean, just to put that in perspective, in the United States, if you were to cut your deficit in half, that would mean a cut of $780 billion if there was no increase in tax revenue. In Germany, it would be a cut of 30 billion euros. And this is why we're seeing ever larger protests in Europe right now, not just in Greece, but in just over the weekend in Italy, there was a general strike. In France, I mean, yeah, I know they're always having general strikes, but they're getting pretty worked up there too, Spain. And it's because people, the banner that they're marching under in Europe is "We won't pay for your crisis." And it's particularly acute in the context of the G20 because at the same time as they decided to pass on the bill for the crisis to regular people, coming in the form of cuts to pensions, cuts to health care, cuts to unemployment insurance, they decided not to impose a tax on banks, which was one of the ideas on the agenda. They decided not to impose a transaction tax, a financial transaction tax, that had also been proposed as a way to raise revenue to deal with the crisis, to support social programs, to support action on climate change. They decided not to take clear action cutting subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. In all of these ways, that was too complicated. They couldn't agree. But the one thing they agreed on was that they would pass on the cost of this crisis to the poor. So, I think what happened in my city is a scandal. As a person who lives in Toronto, I'm embarrassed. Embarrassed of my Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who only has a minority in this country. He only won a third of the vote, but because of our parliamentary system, he holds power. And personally, I don't think that a third of the popular vote should give you the right to rule Canada, let alone be telling other countries how they should be running theirs.
It would be good if you had a runoff.
Yeah.
Something. But I'm curious what you think on a couple levels here. I'm really curious what your analysis is of just what the G20 really is. I mean, you link to a really interesting article by Ibbotson and Perkins that I read as well about how your former finance minister, Paul Martin and and Lawrence Summers created this. So talk a bit about that history and what
really
you think is going on here.
Because the G20 seemed to come out of nowhere. I mean, we had the G7 and then we had the G8. It's only been in the past 2 years that leaders of the G20 have started to meet. And in Pittsburgh last year, when Pittsburgh hosted the G20, it was announced that the G20 was essentially going to replace the G8. This was going to be the big power broker configuration now. But for some reason, they still had a G8 summit before they had a G20 summit. These guys like summits. But before that, the G20 had been meeting just at the ministerial level. Finance ministers from around the world would meet. And the idea for it emerged in 1999, and there's never been a history told of how this institution came to be. I guess it wasn't considered important enough until now. But these reporters did do a history, and they interviewed Paul Martin, our former prime minister, and they interviewed Larry Summers. And what they found out was that the whole idea was born in Larry Summers' office, who at that time was Bill Clinton's nominee for Treasury Secretary. The G8, or at the time the G7, was coming under pressure from increasingly powerful developing countries like China and India, basically saying, you know, we want into the club. And so Paul and Larry sat down and decided to expand the G7. And they didn't have a piece of paper, which I find bizarre, but apparently Larry Summers doesn't have paper in his office. But they found an envelope. And so they flipped the envelope over. And on the back of this envelope, Larry Summers dictated the countries that he wanted to join the G20. And the article gets into how they made these decisions, because a lot of people assume that it's just the countries with the biggest GDP got invited, but that's not true. I mean, it is true that China, India, South Africa, Brazil, like the biggest developing country governments got in, but after that, it really became all about geopolitics. So, you know, they wouldn't want Iran or Egypt in, but yes, they wanted Saudi Arabia in, and they decided to go with Indonesia because Indonesia was more important for political reasons than Thailand, things like that. So what emerges from this story is just what an incredibly top-down, arbitrary, ad hoc institution this is. And so why exactly should we be taking orders from them and not, say, the United Nations or something with some like legal legitimacy?
So what do you think is going on here with the G20? One of the things they said in that article was that Larry Summers was this glowing about how real debate took place among the finance ministers. It never took place in G8 or other places that were much more scripted the way he was describing it. I mean, what do you think analytically is going on here? I mean, what in this G20 process?
Well, I think that the rise of powers like Brazil and Italy, and India and China, South Africa, does presents both opportunity and challenge to the traditional Western powers. I think from the perspective of the corporations in G8 countries, they want access to those markets. We know that. And so, but at the same time, there is a fear of a genuine shift in power from north to south, because if the new configuration of power is that China's wealth translates into all of Asia having more power in global negotiations, or if Brazil's new wealth translates into all of Latin America speaking together and in one voice, that is really going to erode the power of the people who are used to calling the shots, the G7, G8 countries. So my analysis of what the G20 is all about and the fact that it's getting more power is that this is the traditional Western countries, Europe, the United States, Canada, et cetera, trying to find a way to expand their club to the nouveau riche, but not lose their own power, not get outvoted by the developing world, which is why the General Assembly is not a place where people like to make decisions, because the West loses a lot of votes in that context. So I think where you really start to see how this plays out. For instance, I saw it firsthand because I was in Copenhagen during the climate change negotiations, covering those negotiations. And that was shortly after the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh, where it was announced that this is really going to replace the G8. And what happened in Copenhagen is that instead of negotiating as a unified bloc, the developing world, and that's what usually happens, they negotiate in a group called the G77. So that's China and India and South Africa, but it's also smaller countries without much power, like Bolivia, for instance, or the Maldives. So instead of that happening, China and India and Brazil and South Africa broke away, joined with the U.S., and announced that they had made their own deal. And they didn't need the votes of the other countries. These were the big, powerful countries, the big economies, the big emitters, and they had forged what they called the Copenhagen Accord. And so they really undermined the United Nations, and they imposed what they called a solution from the top down, and it was a solution that has very damaging effects for island states, for countries that are really on the front lines of the climate crisis. So that's what I think the G20 is all about. It's about a new alliance between the most powerful countries in the North and South.
And how does
and
that...
about making sure that the developing world as a whole doesn't become stronger.
That's very interesting. An interesting analysis. And how does that fit into... When you wrote The Shock Doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, how does all this fit into the power of the transnational corporations and their role in all this?
Well, I mean, first of all, I wrote The Shock Doctrine because I was hoping that if we understood that our elites use crisis, use disaster to push through policies that they can't push through during normal times, that we would be better equipped to resist it when it happens. So, I believe that we're seeing a very vivid example of The Shock Doctrine right now with what just happened with the G20, where you have governments that would have, like, for instance, in Britain right now, they're calling... The budget that was just handed down by the new government, by the conservative liberal Dem government, the Shock Doctrine budget, because they came to power talking about how moderate they were going to be, and then as soon as they came to power, they decided that they needed an emergency budget because the economic crisis was so deep, and they're pushing draconian cuts. Like some government departments are being cut overnight by 25%. These are cuts that the likes of which they haven't seen since Margaret Thatcher. So it's a clear example. And now the G20 has just decided that they're going to do this across the board in every member country. So, this is a really clear example of how elites collude during times of crisis, really to get around democracy. And that's why I think it's really important in this moment for progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call yourselves,
right,
to recognize that there is a budget crisis. I mean, this is real. I mean, when you transfer huge amounts of public money into private hands, which is what happened when we decided to save the banks in the way that we did, and you don't spend similar resources keeping people in their homes, keeping people in their jobs, then your tax base collapses. So you're shoveling money out the door, you lose your tax base, and lo and behold, you have a debt and deficit crisis. So it's not enough just to say, well, we don't think the poor should pay for this, we won't pay for your crisis. We also have to put alternative sources of revenue on the table. And that's where it means pushing really hard for things like the financial transaction tax, like a bank tax, I think windfall profit taxes for the fossil fuel industry, at the very least eliminating subsidies, big cuts to military, if you ask me, and so on, because the economic crisis is real. We can't just be against their solutions. We have to put real solutions on the table.
That's interesting, how you're concluding that thought, the idea of putting other solutions on the table, because it seems to me that, I think a lot of people are trying to put their hands around what's happening globally.
Yeah.
I mean, you were in Copenhagen, and one of the things that struck me about Copenhagen was there were 100,000 people from every continent on the globe, led by women, indigenous people, poor people of every race, in the streets of Copenhagen. You saw what just happened in Detroit, 18,000 activists, the same kind of multiracial coalition going on there. The meeting in Cochabamba with indigenous leaders. I'm curious what you think is... what the response is to G20 that way, and what do you think is happening here, and does it have any effective power outside of the street?
I sure hope so.
because right.
you're absolutely right. I mean, something is happening. These are new configurations, or even when they're not new, they're stronger than they were before, and we saw that just now in the response to the G20 here in Toronto. We were were simulcasting some of the events with the Social Forum in Detroit. And I was in Cochabamba for the Alternative Climate Change Summit that Evo Morales called after the collapse of Copenhagen. And it's not yet clear what the intersection is going to be between the ideas that are emerging out of these spaces and the existing power structures. Where you see the closest to sort of a policy plan would be in the Cochabamba context, where that alternative summit wasn't just like a usual World Social Forum type of meeting where people just get together and sort of dream about the world they want. It was designed as an intervention in the UN climate negotiations. So the idea was to create a space where social movements, indigenous people, could get together, decide on what their real solutions were, and put them in the language that the United Nations understands, you know, in the resolutions that they understand, the categories that they understand. And that did happen, that the Morales government led a delegation of social movement leaders to submit the proposals that came out of Cochabamba, like for instance, that there should be a criminal court for environmental crimes, which after the BP disaster, I think the case for that is stronger than ever. And also calling for the recognition of the concept of climate debt, which is the recognition that climate change is a crisis that was created by the rich and the northern countries with our emissions, and the effects of it are overwhelmingly being felt in the south, in the countries that are least responsible for creating the crisis. So the solutions should recognize that imbalance, that inequality. So these proposals are being made, but they're not shaking the foundations of power quite yet.
And I wonder sometimes if when you look at what just went on in the G20 and this incredible idea, as you mentioned in the very beginning, about slashing budgets by 2013, if it says that capitalism as we know it now cannot answer the questions we face.
It really does feel that way, and especially when so many of the most pressing crises that we face are actively taken off the agenda. I mean, we were talking about climate change a year ago, but suddenly the economic crisis becomes the excuse for why we can't talk about climate change anymore, because we can only talk about economic growth. And that was another one of the decisions that was made at this G20 summit, was to not take any action on climate change except in the context of economic growth. And that's where you really see the tensions between the capitalist model that we have and a much deeper crisis that we face as a species. Because, in my country, in Canada, our emissions are up 35% since we signed the Kyoto Protocol because of the Alberta tar sands. The Alberta tar sands are, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's a terrifying place where we are turning really solid mass. The oil is in solid form, is in the tar, and you have to boil the earth to extract the liquid. It takes 3 to 5 times more energy to convert this tar into oil than it does just to drill for traditional crude. And this is, this is connected to the BP disaster as well, because this is what Michael T. Clare calls extreme. We're in the age of extreme oil. The accessible stuff isn't available anymore, so we're going for the more dangerous stuff that has the higher cost, whether the cost is the risk of a devastating spill because it's so hard to get to and so deep below the earth, or whether it's just the everyday disaster that is the tar sands. I mean, it looks like a disaster every day of the week. You don't need a spill. It's a spill all the time. So it really does feel like this model is coming to a very dangerous end. And we need to get off this course very quickly. And the G20 sure is not going to get us there. Vandana Shiva, at this event that I spoke at on Friday night, the Indian physicist, a wonderful speaker. It was an honor to share the platform with her. And she started her speech. She says, "Oh, the G20, so young and yet so old."
That's very good. Yeah. Finally, I just what I said I would ask in the very beginning, because you raised it again, is the seemingly powerless of the world,
mm-hmm.
the indigenous people and others, in many ways are at the fulcrum of this, or at the leadership of what's going on right now.
Yeah.
I find very fascinating.
It is true. And also, because, and this is also connected to this age of extreme resource extraction, whether it's coal, whether it's oil, you know, whether it's gold, whether it's silver, I think we are in an age that deserves to be understood as like the final colonial pillage. The price of commodities are very high because of scarcity, and they are also in the most remote, hardest to reach parts of the world. And that necessarily actually means that they are on territory that is the last remaining indigenous-controlled territory. And there's a direct correlation between the remoteness and the presence of indigenous people, because indigenous people have been pushed to the margins of our continents. And so it's not just that indigenous people are leading this movement, you know, intellectually with framings and at conferences. It's also that they're defending the land, defending the earth at the sites of extraction. And what's there was a great demonstration in Toronto during the G20 on Friday called Defenders of the Land. Was it Friday or Thursday? Defenders of the Land, which was organized by indigenous people in Canada, but in cooperation with non-indigenous people. And this was the framing of recognizing indigenous people as defending the last places left, and also the connection between defending those resources, in many cases keeping them in the ground, and our hopes of actually averting climate chaos. So it's a very interesting, very important shift and alliance. And frankly, I think it's our best hope. And I'm really glad you're talking about it, Mark. Thank you.
Well, Naomi Klein, I want to thank you for your mind, your analysis, and your activism. And I appreciate you taking a time out today for our listeners to hear what you have to say.
Thank you.
And folks, don't forget to read The Shock Doctrine and go to Naomi Klein's website, which you can tag onto on our website right now. Naomi, thanks so much. Those are the sounds from the first day and the march that took place at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit that we covered last week. Of course, I'm sitting here with Anthony McCarthy, because it is Monday. We'll remind you, but first we get into this, that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. Find out more at www.hopkinsmedicine.org. And we'll bring you some other stories later in the week that we did there. Didn't have time to put on the air last week, some really interesting conversations we had. But we're bringing in the studio now three folks who were there in Detroit and share their thoughts and ideas about what happened there and what they think significance of it all was, or insignificance maybe, we'll see. Ryan Harvey's with us. He's founding member of the Civilian Soldier Alliance. Marilyn Shaw's with us, who's a youth organizer with the Baltimore Algebra Project. And Dr. Margaret Flowers is with us. She's co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. And you're also the Congressional Fellow, still?
For the National, yes.
Yes, good. Make sure I had that right.
Thank you.
Number here is 410-319-8888 to throw your comments in. So tell me, Marilyn, let me start with you. I mean, what did you think of your experience there? Talk a bit about what you kind of got from it all for being there for a week.
Well, we went, the Bottom Algebra Project went with the purpose of, like, talking about youth jobs, connecting with other organizations, see what the conversation was about youth jobs and youth activism and the school-to-prison pipeline. And we just learned that organizations across the country are dealing with the same issues as far as the lack of youth jobs and dealing with the school-to-prison pipeline. You've gone from school to prison instead of from school to higher education. So it was, I guess it gave us kind of hope to see that we're not the only ones fighting for youth jobs and trying to end the school-to-prison pipeline. So,
I mean, what you just said, I think, is significant the at the end there, that's I get that sense from a lot of people who are there, that the sense of people from localities across the nation getting a sense that you're not isolated, you're not alone,
right.
You're not in this by yourself.
Right, yeah.
Margaret?
Thank you, Mark. Well, I was marching in that parade. It was very exciting. Thousands of people. I think, my issue is healthcare. And I was there with representing Physicians for National Health Program, but with other member groups that we work with in the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare, Healthcare Now, and some of the labor organizations. Our point of being there, we had a People's Movement Assembly, and we're really raising up the voices of those who haven't had a voice. So we kind of stepped back a little bit and brought those in who are being really severely affected by our lack of a health system in this society, and finding ways to support them and to elevate their voices in this movement, because it's so important. We recognize that health is really not just health care. It's access to clean food and a safe environment, adequate education. And so we're really looking to join the various movements together in this struggle.
Right.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned about not feeling alone, I think that's one of the really important aspects of the social forum. And I was at the one in Atlanta a few years ago as well, the first U.S. social forum, and that was the main thing, kind of the main overall thing I took away from that. It's really a space where you can come and share with other organizations, other movements, and learn different skills that those movements have, but also leaving with a rejuvenated feeling that, there's a few more years of hard work, and then you'll see a lot of those faces again. That's a lot of people to bring together. And coming up in a lot of the large summit protests as a young person against, like, the G8, what's now the G20, the World Trade Organization, some of these things, that was like a similar coming together of people, but it was always in a protest situation. It was a heightened alert, and it was an emergency. And a lot of us felt in Detroit, we're like, man, it feels like we should be really scared right now, but it's actually okay. We can actually walk around the city, and everything's fine. And and I think it was, for me, it was neat the way that you framed the show with Naomi Klein speaking right before, and thinking about the G20 having their summit and the U.S. social movements having our summit, having that be sort of this parallel existence. And I think that's a really neat way to frame the whole thing, because that is what it's about.
I'm curious, and I'm sure our listeners are curious about what you took from – something practical you took from the conference. It's great to get together. It's great to be rejuvenated. It's great to feed off of other people's energy. But how do you continue to move these I don't want to say movements, but how do you continue to move these segments of the progressive movement forward? I mean, were there real discussions about what the issues are? Was there real discussions about getting on the same page about the war in Afghanistan, about our children and resources that are available, and certainly health care? Or was it just a time for people to come and vent and let off some steam, march in the streets, but also sit down and realize, as all of you have said, there are people who are in this struggle together? What was the practical benefit for all of these progressives coming together in Detroit?
That's Dr. Flowers. Really excellent point, because I took my teenage daughter and a friend of hers, and at one point she got a little overwhelmed and said, "Mom, is this going to be enough to change things? We need so much change in this country." And that was the point of the social forum, is through these people movement assemblies. They had 52 of them on different topics. These are four-hour groups. They weren't workshops. They were really working groups. We had over 200 people in our healthcare one. These PMAs developed resolutions and action items, and then those were synthesized on the night before the last night into 15 thematic tracks of different types of work that needs to be done in different areas. And so the intention is that these groups in these thematic tracks continue to work together from here, seeing the commonalities of their issues, and continue to communicate. And through our healthcare PMA, in addition to that, we broke out regionally. And so we're going to continue to network on a regional basis, my region being the Southeast, which is actually the least penetrated when it comes to healthcare reform. Yeah. We've chosen to continue to communicate and move towards developing local people movement assemblies in areas like Georgia, New Orleans, South Carolina, areas that haven't been reached, and expand that out to the region to continue bringing more groups in and working together.
Ryan, Marilyn, any thought on that? What was the practical benefit? Did you bring something home that you're going to be able to use with your algebra project here in Baltimore and our Civilian Soldier Alliance?
Well, we were already connected to something that's called the Alliance for Educational Justice, and is made up of different organizations across the country that worked towards educational justice, that work for the, our common goal. So we got to, I guess the practical part about it is like we're connected to them, but we actually got to see the faces we were like working with. And I think that's important in a movement. Like, even though, you know, you might like, it's something like you have a goal to do and you want as many people in as possible, but it's important to establish a relationship with the people you're like working with. So to me, the most practical part about it was like seeing and knowing, like actually seeing the people and knowing that their struggle is this, is my struggle. So now it makes me, I don't know, more angry and more like, I guess, make me work harder because I actually see those faces and not just like talk to them or I don't know. Yeah, so.
We, with the Civilian Soldier Alliance and our partner organization, Iraq Veterans Against the War, we had spent, right before Detroit, we had spent 5 days in Chicago in this intense campaign development organizing training that we had organized together, the two organizations. So we came to Detroit having already done a ton of work, and that'll be announced in 2 weeks. We're going to announce the campaign that Iraq Veterans Against the War is going to launch. It's going to be their first real strategic campaign. And that's something when, you know, talking about the People's Movement Assemblies, the anti-war movement, for what it is now, has always lacked a real strategic focus. And it's a really hard, a war is a really hard thing, especially two wars, that's a really hard thing to organize around. And that was the work we were trying to put in. So we came to the social forum with the intention of meeting folks to help plug into that campaign. So we did a four-hour workshop there and brought a bunch of people we had never worked with in, as well as a bunch of people we had worked with. And it was civilian and veteran co-facilitated, and it went extremely well. So we took home some new contacts, you know, to put into that network. Like another thing that we took home, I'd say a lot of us went to different workshops, not that that weren't anti-war workshops, but maybe that were done by a labor organization or by you know, grassroots journalists or something like that, to get skills that we can apply to our work. So there was a really neat cross-pollination going on that, you know, everyone took home, as well as our movement taking home some general things that were concrete. I think the individuals took home a lot of skills to apply.
I'm here with Anthony McCarthy. It's Monday.
Monday.
We're talking about folks who were at the U.S. Social Forum where we reported last week for WEA and for Free Speech TV all week long up in Detroit. And you can join us here now at 410-319-8888. We're joined by Ryan Harvey, founding member of the Civilian Soldier Alliance, Marilyn Shaw, who's youth organizer with the Baltimore Algebra Project, who we interviewed while we were up there as well, and Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for National Healthcare Program and a congressional fellow with the Physicians for National Healthcare. 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com.
Now, Mark, I'm curious. You were in the media room. You were broadcasting live from there. Do you feel that same energy? I thought it was very telling when you were talking to Naomi
Klein.
She said something's happening, and you said something's happening. Now, I'm cynical at times about this something happening.
I know.
Especially when it comes to progressives, because I've seen progressives try to make things happen. What did you feel?
Or make
when
more
you,
things.
Or
in
make, that's right. What did you see?
Well, I think something is bubbling up in the world. I'm curious what everybody thinks about that. I mean, I think that what I said to Naomi Klein in the interview a little bit ago was that when you saw 100,000 people in Copenhagen, in the streets of Copenhagen, and they came from every continent on the globe, from little tiny villages in Kenya to villages in India to cities, you know, like Nairobi, Paris, Dubuque, Iowa. They came from all over, led by indigenous people, led by women, by poor people, by people of color. I mean, it's never happened before. 100,000 people from every continent on the globe gathered in the street saying, we want a different life. And it was translated to Cochabamba, where Evo Morales, who was president of Bolivia, invited all these workers' groups from South America and indigenous people to come together and gather, and they had these people in Detroit. And it was the same kind of grouping, but all Americans. I mean, it was amazing. The majority of people there were young, 18 to 30 years, in 18 wow. to 30s. Right. Not most, but the majority. That it was the most multiracial group I've ever seen in one place at one time in the United States of America. You know, it was
and working together.
Really? It was just, it was a really very so that gave people a positive, I think, a feeling energy. Did you feel that at all, Marilyn?
No doubt in my mind. I felt like that some type of change was happening. Seeing all the different organizations get together and fighting for different causes, and people recognizing that we do need a new world. But when you go back home and you still see the same problems, that's when I get disappointed. And what I mean by
your anger was coming from,
what I mean by that is we're having a summer camp this summer, and we found out while we were there that half of our students will not have jobs. 9,000 youth applied for summer jobs this summer, and only 6,100 got the jobs. And out of our, we were supposed to get 80 students, the Algebra Project, and we only wind up getting 40. So that's when it gets real, when you realize, like, are we doing enough? So that's the, I see that we're doing stuff across the country, but are we doing enough when we get back home? That's when we know, like, we need to be doing more.
Oh, so that's what that thing on Chris Goodman's Facebook page was saying about why you all were so upset about.
Right. The youth, they just let us know like a week ago that we're not going to have half of our students this summer, and half of them not going to have jobs.
Because of budget cuts.
Right.
Right.
I don't know the reason. So we're just angry because we don't know why half our youth are not going to be working with us this summer. So where are they going to be is our question. And we need to fight so that they do have jobs this summer, so they have a place to be. So,
Margaret, Ryan, you want to comment on this, what Anthony was asking?
You know, I do think it's interesting what you say, because I also get bitter about false hope. Especially among the politically left and the progressives and stuff. I think that's – and, of course, everyone does that, right? you want to hype yourself up to – you want to create the reality by talking about it beforehand. And sometimes you're telling the truth, and sometimes you're hyping it to try and make people feel good, which is an innocent thing. But I get very annoyed by it. And I think that what I took going into the social forum and coming out of it, at least from my perspective with the work that I've been involved in, it's been like a really tough year. It's been a tough 2 years, and the social forum didn't have the sparking energy that the Atlanta social forum had. But that doesn't mean the social forum was bad or anything. Mm-hmm. It's a reflection of the reality that we're living in. And I think that Bush did quite a number, and the shift to Obama and sort of the false hope that Obama brought in during his campaigning, and what he hasn't delivered on, or at least what people expected from him and haven't gotten, has created not a sense of motivation, but more of a desperation and a hopelessness. But the social forum serves to counteract that with practicality. And I'm not walking away from the social forum with, you know, this is the birth of some movement. But it's like, hey, we can do this, and we can pull it off. And this is something that needs to be a fixture in the United States, the way things like it have been a fixture in a lot of other countries.
I had an interesting experience while I was there. You're probably familiar with the deficit commission that the president appointed back in April. And there's an organization called America Speaks, which is privately funded by the Peterson Foundation, that held these 21st century town halls all around the country on the deficit. And major marketing propaganda type of affair. There was one in Detroit, so I attended it, and they allowed me to participate. And so I'm sitting at this table with Detroit people, many of whom didn't know that the social forum was even in town. And we were discussing the deficit and our concerns about the economy. And every person at the table understood that the problem was the corporate control of our government, neoliberal policies. And these
in this Peterson group.
In this workshop of just, you know, people from Detroit who came together. They saw right through the propaganda. this group, America Speaks, this deficit commission, the people that were placed on the commission are people that are very prone to privatizing our Social Security and cutting our Medicaid and Medicare and saying that we need to do that in terms of balancing the budget. I was thinking about that when Naomi Klein was speaking, because it really is causing the poor people to pay for the mistakes of the wealthy. And people in the room weren't buying that. They saw through it. And actually, after the first series where we had to balance what we wanted to cut and how we would raise revenue, and the national moderator came on, because there were 20 of these around the country, the first thing she had to say was, for those of you who would like to make a comment, there is a comment box, because, for instance, people are very upset that we don't have a choice for single payer. And that was what she had to come and say first. And the whole room burst into applause, because the way they scripted this workshop was to get you to agree to cut Medicaid and Medicare.
So what does that say to you?
It says to me that people are getting it. You know, I think people in this country that
it's not just the social forum.
It's not just the social forum. I think that that the general population is starting to see that the policies. I mean, how can you not look at the jobless rates? Look at what people are struggling to get health care in this country. People are starting to wake up and see it, I think.
Any hesitation on any of your part? And I know we have some callers who want to join in the conversation before we run out of time. Give us a call at 410-319-8888. What do you think about the progressive movement in this country? What do you think about the agenda going forward, and how a lot of different groups can make a difference on the issues that they care about? But I'm very curious, any hesitation on any of your parts? And Dr. Flowers and I talked about this before we came on the air. Any hesitancy at all? And you had a great answer, so I'm trying to steer you in that direction. Any hesitancy at all after 8 years of George Bush? The right calls Barack Obama the most liberal president elected in the history of this country. Any hesitancy at all with a Democrat in the White House, both houses of Congress controlled by Democrats, both of those institutions saying, give us time, we're moving in the direction, we're trying to build these coalitions. Any hesitancy? Progressives, when I was reading the blogs when Mark was in Detroit and I was listening to him, but I was also reading a lot of the other progressive writers and thinkers who were there, they were blasting Obama's financial team. They were blasting the CDC. They were blasting the White House. Any hesitancy on your part with progressives, quote unquote, in power, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Barack Obama, to really be taking them to task so early in their administration?
Right. I know some people are uncomfortable with that, and you expressed some discomfort with the fact that I pushed on them so hard. I think that it's imperative that we do that, because there's no way – if you want to look at it, one way to look at it is that you provide them cover to move in the direction that they need to move in. They keep moving to the right. And so – but what I've been telling when I speak around – when I speak is the things that I learned out of this health reform process boil down to the three initials ICU, which are appropriate considering we have a health care crisis that needs intensive care. And this is what a movement has got to remember. Movements are independent. They can't be based on fear of someone not getting elected. They have to have clarity. They have to know exactly what it is that they're asking for. And they have to be uncompromising, because if we compromise for the political parties, we're never going – if they know that we're willing to compromise, we're never going to get where we need to be. So ICU is what I've been saying.
Nathan or Marilyn, any hesitancy as a progressive movement to be critical of this White House, of the Democrats that are in charge of Congress? Nathan?
Oh, Wait, Ryan.
Who's Nathan? Anyway.
No wonder I wasn't responding.
That's right.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking with the work that I've done with the Civilian Soldier Alliance and with Iraq Veterans Against the War, I mean, Iraq Veterans Against the War had a 10,000-person march outside of the Democratic convention. And they had no problem calling Obama out on anti-war policy and saying, hey, we're anti-war too. Here's what we're talking about. And we were there. And I don't think that the people of Baltimore – I was out in the streets after Obama got elected celebrating with a lot of people. And I don't think people are out there celebrating because they wanted to have their kids go from Iraq to Afghanistan. The more time that we wait and give space for things like that, that's three or four more soldiers and Marines that are going to die every day in Afghanistan. And I don't think that – I think that it's – you know, this, they said now this has been the longest war in U.S. history. I think that's waiting long enough.
Do you think – though, not to get too deep in this, going to ask some questions about the social forum. We have a lot of people calling in. We've got to get some calls here. But sometimes people would argue that progressives themselves do themselves a disservice by attacking Obama rather than fighting for what they want to see. That you begin to divide too many people apart.
A lot.
Because a lot of, you know, I mean, it's a broad spectrum of people from moderate to left that I call the Obama demographic that put him into office. You know, and there's, and it, there's a, there, you know, there may be strategically better ways to address this, some people might argue.
Well, I'll throw my sentence in, and then if you want to
go ahead,
respond.
Marilyn.
No, you can go ahead.
And you know, and I voted for Obama. I think the only thing that I'm the only thing I'm afraid of is the far right, the Tea Party types, this veiled racist movement. But I think that we don't do any we don't help at all by acting like there's no problem going on with Obama, because that makes us, I think it makes us look like we don't know what's going on. But if we have a strong response, if social justice movements have a strong response and say, hey, stick to what you said you were going to do and stick to our agenda, maybe some of those people who are moving in that direction will move in our direction if we tell them a different story.
I do believe I agree with you what you said, Ryan. But if we as an independent organization focus on what we have to do and our goal at hand, we will ultimately hold him accountable for whatever he said he was going to do when we put him into office. So that's how I feel about the situation.
Let me leap into the phones here, about not literally but figuratively, to get people on the air with this. A lot of people calling in 410-319-8888. Let's see. Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm calling in regards to someone who feels that, you know, is active in the community and considers himself a community activist and organizer. And I know some folks that actually did go to the social forum, and they said it was a very dynamic conference or social forum stuff. But speaking in Baltimore and the progressive movement in general, I do think there's a broader problem in regards to, as progressive, as unity as whole, as among people on the left, of actually showing solidarity and supporting each other's movement. And I have a much, much mad respect for the Algebra Project and other organizations. But having said that, a lot of times as an organizer, as an activist, you're reaching out on different issues and different causes, but one who believes that they're all connected together and we need to support each other, that sometimes you will go up and try to outreach and try to broaden and make people get together, but they've only focused on their issue and not showing support around youth unemployment. Well, we have a problem with unemployment in general. So, you know, in the 60s, the youth movement wasn't just about civil rights, even though that was their cutting issue that they were organizing around, but against the war, police brutality, economic issues. And what I'm saying is that as activists, we need to support each other's struggle. And so when someone comes to you and says, support me, you know, that's what solidarity is all about. It's supporting each other, and I think there's a lot of division that goes on and people discrediting organizations, saying they're far left or they're this or they're that or whatever. And I do agree, you know, we don't have to attack Obama, you know, because it was a historical moment in our history, in the of race nature of our country. And if we organize around the issues and support each other, you know, we can all kind of agree that if we put that we could actually make some change.
Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, Dr. Flowers mentioned, and I think it's very key, it goes along with what Stephen was sharing with us, that oftentimes, even with healthcare, we have to learn in the progressive and the social forum and other progressive gatherings, you realize that healthcare really is not just about healthcare. Healthcare is about access to quality healthcare. It's access to quality housing. It's access to quality education. It's access to quality food. That really the issues that these young people are fighting for and that healthcare organizations are fighting for are really connected. But oftentimes, Mark, progressives, and I guess because I consider myself to be somewhat progressive, they become so narrow. And that when young people put out a call for action and say, we need everybody to come, people and other groups go, oh, well, that's not our issue. And we're not talking about youth jobs. So, no, we won't show up at their action. Whereas really, the more voices that have come together, the more the decision makers, and let's be honest, progressives aren't in positions to make a lot of decisions in this city, really in this country. And so the more voices, progressive voices, as Stephen said, that come together, I think the more impactful that they all will be. Yeah, it's key.
I would agree 100%. I mean, I think that if we do have the political power within, you know, with our numbers, but it comes from creating a unified social and economic justice movement, and that's how change has happened in the past. And so
that's
during
how
the civil
Obama
rights,
was elected.
Right. Yeah, it was really about an anti-poverty campaign, and that's what we need.
Let me go back to the phones here, 410-319-8888, and Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm an old 60s lefty, and my main advice is to not be reactive, but to think through the issues, the important issues, and present your own program and then with it rather than being reactive. I'll give you an example. Yesterday or the day before, I think Bernie Sanders proposed a estate tax reform, and he proposed a $3.5 million exemption. So he's already given up most of the fight by allowing the other side to dictate such an exemption that 99.5% of people would be exempt from estate tax.
It's tough being in Congress. People have not learned how to create a wall saying the progressives in Congress have learned what the Republicans learned, which is how to stand up and say what they believe and fight for it. That's one of the problems, I think. Let me ask the three of a quick question here, though. There were some 15,000 to 18,000 people end up showing up there, but I don't know the exact number they ended up with. None of the national press covered it. 500 Tea Party people demonstrate in Washington, and they talk about it for 3 weeks. What do you think that's about?
It's very simple.
But the press, we're accused always of being liberal. So why do you think it's simple?
Oh, it's very simple because the mainstream media, the people that serve on the boards and advertise on those media outlets, are the same corporations that are influencing our governmental policies and profiting off the current situation. And so our voices are silenced because they direct that our voices be silenced. We run into that all the time in the single-payer movement.
When we were doing the research for this, I mean, the only video I could find was video taken by activists at this event.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
right.
Some progressive media. Mm-hmm. CBS. I mean, well, no, I should say stations, actually. But the mainstream media did not post anything about this huge gathering.
In Detroit itself, the only two media that covered it in Detroit was the Black Press and the equivalent to the Baltimore City paper, the Metro Detroit.
Metro, yeah.
They were the only two, you know. It's pretty stunning. That
I think that the big time, the corporate media want simple to understand, explosive stories, like nothing that makes you have to think too much. They want to market it for you. And the Tea Party is controversial enough and whatnot.
A closing thought from Marilyn is...
Oh, I was just going to comment also. I guess the mainstream media doesn't want to know. I guess the reason why they didn't film Detroit is because they don't want to know that there's people out there working towards developing a new world. They want to, you know, they want to keep the idea in people's mind that, you know, this is how things should be and how they're going to stay. But we are working towards a new world. So,
all right.
Marilyn Shaw.
Yes.
Youth organizer for the Baltimore Algebra Project. Ryan Harvey, founding member of the Civilian Soldier Alliance, Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for National Health, Physicians for National Healthcare Program and National Healthcare Program's Congressional Fellow. Thank you all for joining Anthony McCarthy and I today here on the air. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Glad you all were in Detroit, too. It's a good week up there. And we'll have more of those Detroit stories on our website and here during the course of the week. And Anthony and I will be back right after this brief break. Thank you all for calling in. Sorry we didn't get to as many callers as I want to, but the discussion kind of ran away with it, which is okay because it was a good discussion and good to have you all with us in the studio. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back as we look at why in this city of ours it is a truth that 40% of all 911 calls for rape get dismissed. And then after that, over 30% of all rape victims have their cases said are not serious and then not
unfounded.
Investigated.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that happening in Baltimore? We discuss that when we come back. Stay with us.
Ain't no power like the power of people, cause the power of people don't stop. Copa.